Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Engaging Courts and Building Court Agency Collaborations, co-sponsored by the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Legal and Judicial Issues. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host, Anita St. Ange. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to welcome you on behalf of the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement to our conference today on Engaging Courts. We have a couple of wonderful presenters who are going to talk to us about their current work with the ABA, the National Judicial Resource Center. Starting with the Honorable William Jones, who's a retired juvenile family court judge. He has served 25 years at the Mecklenburg County District Court in North Carolina, sorry. He's been a longtime member of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges and its Permanency Planning and Family Violence Departments. In Charlotte, North Carolina, he was instrumental in establishing the Guardian Ad Litem Program and the Children's Law Center, a supervised visitation center, and family court. He continues to sit as an emergency judge in North Carolina and serves on two court-appointed panels charged with monitoring compliance by child welfare agencies with U.S. District Court injunctions and acts as a consultant to various communities and programs regarding children and families in the court. And I have worked with Bill Jones for a number of years, doing a number of different projects having to do with child welfare and domestic violence, and he's a great resource in that area. Our second presenter is Judge Stephen W. Rideout, who's retired, and he was 15 years as Chief Judge of the Alexandria Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court. And that is and was a model court. He has been involved, led a number of projects and supported others, resulting in a significant reduction in the court's caseload and improved services and programs for children and families in Alexandria. He was the lead judge for the Alexandria Pilot Juvenile Court Project for the Commonwealth of Virginia and was a member of a number of state task forces that address issues of juvenile delinquency, gangs, and custody, and worked on behalf of Virginia's court improvement programs to improve systems of collaboration regarding cases of abuse and neglect of children and termination of parental rights. Both judges have been very involved in the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges and a number of other areas, and both have received numerous awards and accolades that I won't get into so that we can actually hear from them. They have both been consulting with the ABA's Resource Center to improve both as a resource for court improvement program folks, but also one of the big efforts is to improve how the courts and agencies are collaborating with regard to the CFSR. And we are going to hear from them about their current efforts and also on model courts. The way we've designed this, we're going to have some discussion about the history and background and some of their current work. And then hopefully we'll engage in some dialogue with you having to do with some questions about model courts and best practices and the kinds of things that are going on in the field. So I am going to turn it over to Judge William Jones.
Thanks, Anita.
Uh-huh.
And welcome to all of you who are on the line. We look forward to talking to you later. I became a judge in the mid-70s and first began to hear juvenile cases, including child abuse and neglect, in the late 70s, and at that time the only people in the courtroom besides the clerk and I were the social worker and sometimes the parents. There were no lawyers for children or no guardians ad litem for children or other lay advocates. There were no lawyers for parents, and the agency was not represented by counsel either. It was a very different world. And I tell you that just to give you some perspective on how far we've come since then. There was one piece of legislation, federal legislation, on the books at that time, and that was the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which was passed in 1973. Since then, there have been numerous congressional enactments regarding child abuse and neglect and the juvenile court process, particularly 96-272, the adoption and safe, adoption and, help me, Steve. The Adoption and Safe Families Act, and then before that, 96-272, was another major enactment in the early, in the 1980s. The juvenile and family courts are unique courts. They are, some of you I'm sure have heard of, problem-solving courts, courts that try to identify or are designed to serve unique circumstances, such as child abuse and neglect, and to involve the families in those cases in a process that includes protecting the children from harm, rehabilitating the parents, a healing process, if you will. It's not a process that makes that has a trial and makes a decision and that's the end of the case. It's an ongoing process with multiple hearings and multiple facets. The next thing I want to talk about is the genesis of the Child and Family Service Review. It began, let me back up. The court, the Child Welfare Agency, as you know, was funded largely by the federal government. The use of the funds was monitored by the agency to determine whether the money was being appropriately spent. There were paper reviews, but in the late 90s and early part of this century, Congress and the Children's Bureau determined that it would be more appropriate to look at the quality of the work being done by agencies to serve children and families. And so the Child and Family Service Review was born of that process and that determination. The first round of reviews was conducted beginning in 2001 and concluded in 2004. All 50 states and two additional jurisdictions, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, were reviewed, and all 52 of those jurisdictions were found wanting in terms of their compliance with the expectations of the CFSR. There were three general outcomes as a part of that review process: safety, permanency, and well-being, and each of those contained several specific measures for determining the outcomes. There were additionally systemic factors that were weighed in the balance in determining a state's performance in the review process. In the first round of reviews, courts were minimally involved, and that was particularly true in the early stages. Because this was a three-plus year process, it changed over time, and toward the end of that period, some courts were able to become more actively engaged in the process. But generally speaking, courts were not encouraged or invited to participate except to the extent that they, some of the local judges participated in what were called stakeholder interviews. But success in achieving good results for children and families in child abuse and neglect cases requires active, effective participation not only by the agency but also by the courts. And so as the second round of CFSRs began last year, the agency determined that it would involve or attempt to involve the courts to a far greater extent in the process. And Steve and I were invited to be the ambassadors, if you will, from the Children's Bureau through the ABA Center on Children and the Law to facilitate a better working relationship between the agency and the courts in each state as those reviews came online. And for the last year, I guess, we've gone to maybe 15, 16, 17 different jurisdictions to have those conversations with the Chief Justice and with the presiding judge of the largest jurisdiction and with the director of the Child Welfare Agency. And our objective has been to promote collaborative working relationships among and between those individuals and the institutions they represent for the purpose of achieving better outcomes for children and families. And I think I'll stop there, Steve, and yield to you.
Okay. Anybody have any questions of Bill before I take off?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. I'm showing no questions at this time.
Okay, great. Thanks. Our conversation really is about engaging courts and building court and agency collaboration. And just to maybe follow a little bit on what Bill was talking about, when I went on the bench in 1989, we had the courts around the country should have been for the previous 9 years or so been engaged in working with and providing oversight to child welfare agencies regarding kids in care. And I have to say, even though I had been a substitute judge for 6 years prior to going on the bench full time, I didn't have a clue about this. There was just, we didn't get any training. There was nothing out there that helped me to know that I should be doing anything other than hearing what the Department of Social Services said and then pat them on the back and say, great job, and move on, because we just weren't trained. And I don't think that I was, or our court was any different than any other courts around the country. And it really wasn't for me until we got engaged in the model court process in 1995 that I, in reading the resource guidelines, that I came to understand that if we are going to do these cases well and right, we really have to be at the table at the same time, and we have to be talking about these issues and getting away from finger pointing and getting away from not treating the people, the social workers who come before us professionally, making sure that we have trained lawyers, all of those kinds of things, so that we can get better outcomes for children. So what when Bill and I were asked to do this work, we then began with the first group of states, which was, I think, was 14 or 15, but we went to three of them together just to get a sense of what this work was all about. We certainly planned and prepared and anticipated what was going to be happening as we tried to find out how states were collaborating and cooperating, but also to bring to them some ideas that we had from our experience of being model courtly judges as to how that might happen better. So the first three states, I would say, were almost guinea pigs for us and we for them. For those of you in those three states, I apologize, but we really were trying to use what experience we had, but we really didn't have any experience in this particular arena because courts really hadn't been reached out to around the country. What we found early on was eagerness by court systems and agencies to work collaboratively. It was clear from the previous CFSR round that everyone came to the realization that the courts needed to be at the table. Something Anita did not mention, but one of the other things that I've done is I am on our statewide stakeholders group for our Child and Family Service Review in Virginia. And so I was at the table back in 2001 and 2002 and 2003 as we began our preparations and began trying to get ourselves ready for our participation in the CFSR. And out of that experience, I learned even more about how we needed to be talking with one another and not at one another or past one another. Over the first year of our doing this work, we went to states, and I'll talk a little bit later on about some of the positives and some of the challenges I saw in those states. But for the most part, we saw chief justices who were engaged in this process, who wanted to have these cases work better, who had challenges within their own court systems in getting trial judges and courts of appeals to move these cases expeditiously. They had their resource issues, as did the head of child welfare, as did the chief judge of the largest jurisdiction. And everybody, it seemed, had a number of sort of different issues, but we are finding over the work that we've done so far that there are certain kinds of cases that and issues that keep popping up. And again, we'll talk about that here. What has happened is we have finished the first group of states, and there are now 19 to which Bill and I will be going between now and early next year. And I'll just read you off a list of them to give you a sense. And certainly there may be a change simply because somebody gets sick or something, and some Bill may fill in for me or me for him. But the plan is that I'll be going and I've gone to Florida. I have to go back to Miami to meet with the chief judge there. But Bill's going to Arkansas. I'm going to California. Bill's going to Texas. He's also going to Idaho, North Dakota, New York, and South Dakota. I'm going to be trying to schedule Wyoming and Colorado together at some point during August. I'm also going to Kentucky probably in October. And Bill's going to Nebraska at this juncture, it looks like November. I'll be in Pennsylvania in November and Ohio in November, Tennessee in October, Montana in September. And then Bill, you may want to reconsider this, but it looks like you may be going to Alaska in January, and then West Virginia and Connecticut. In any event, the process that we go through when we go to the states is that we meet with the chief justice, head of child welfare, and the chief judge of the largest jurisdiction. We try, when possible, to have all of those people together with support staff and CIP directors and child welfare, the person who's in charge of the CFSR process, whoever that the people in the state want to have at the table, we like to have them there so that we can get a full picture of what's going on. Sometimes simply because of logistics, we can't meet with everybody at the same time, and that's fine too. But we go as guests of the state, so we don't feel that we can insist that, everybody come together. So we say, we suggest if you want to have everybody, that'd be great. One of the things that we found was early on is that we didn't give states enough information about what we really wanted to be talking about. And so we've prepared a list of about a dozen discussion items that we would like to, at some point during the conversation, take up and at least touch base on. Now, in addition to that, what we're starting this next round that we're starting right now is that we'll also want to meet with CIP director and the person in charge for the state of the CFSR process, whoever's been assigned by the agency, to try to drill down into the collaboration and cooperation discussion to look at the depth of that work, how long it's been going on, how what kind of systems have been put in place to support it, look at transitions that may have occurred, and how the ongoing systems work can continue when there are transitions in leadership in the court system or in the agency. The reason being that it's our belief that if this work is done in a systematic way where institutions, if that's the right word, are put in place that will support this work, then as people move from one position to another and somebody new comes in, the system will be there to support that that ongoing work. An example of that is in Alexandria, where with our model court project, for instance, I was the lead judge when I retired, and in anticipation of my retirement, Judge Dawkins and I worked on developing that transition, and what we wound up doing is transitioning that into a dual leadership of Judge Dawkins and Deborah Collins, who's the head of our child welfare agency in the city, so that we now are a dual cooperative, collaborative group as opposed to a model court, as opposed to simply a judge-led process. Our aim is hopefully by the end of this calendar year that we will have been out to visit with all the states to talk with them about this process, to answer questions as best we can, to provide ideas and resources, to introduce, if you aren't aware, to other resource centers who can provide assistance and services, so that your state can have the best possible results out of your CFSR process. I have to tell you that as I've been doing this work, I mean, I get really excited about hearing from the states not only the things that they're doing well, but the challenges that they're facing, because in those challenges, I see the real opportunity to make systems change that is really going to improve the lives of children and families, and get kids to permanency, hopefully back home sooner rather than later. It's just a philosophy that I was able to develop as a result of the work that I did in Model Court and what I learned from all the other judges around the country. We're seeing around the country court systems. I have to tell you, Arizona, I was just overwhelmed by the terrific work that they're doing out there in terms of making systems change, but also the huge challenges that they have given the growth that they are seeing in their particular state, not only in population, but in the case filings. And there are others. Kansas was another terrific state. I've just been back to Delaware, and I think they're on the threshold of just of making some really terrific, significant changes that will really raise the bar for everyone in terms of getting these kids to permanency sooner. So with that, I will stop yakking and say if anybody's got a question about what I've talked about, be happy to answer them. And then I think we're going to be talking, trying to get into some details, and be happy to do that.
Thank you, Steve. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Sir, I'm not showing any questions at this time.
Okay, great. Anita, I think we had talked about just moving into the discussion of some of the challenges and positives that we were seeing, and if unless you have another idea, I'll be happy to start those off.
No, I think at this point you were going to start talking about some of your stories, some of your experiences. I think that would be great.
I'll just start with continuances. One of the things that I'm seeing around the country is these cases are being continued too often. and certainly it is not in every jurisdiction, but it is either being continued because lawyers just come in and say, I agree to a continuance and the judge has granted it, or continuances where the case has been set for trial, you have a hearing, but it's not completed, and you then have to continue it over to another date for a rehearing, and that date is set out several months because, or a month or several months because everybody's schedule, you know, having all the lawyers, you know, looking at their schedule plus the court docket plus you know, available witnesses, it just it moves these cases out. So one of the things, and I'm working in a state where in a particular county, the issue of continuances came up, and I was able to do a study of one of the lawyers for the agency had for a 2-year period kept a log of the cases and how often they had been continued. Well, I took that information and did a study of it, and I mean we were seeing in some of those cases the children, the cases had been continued for over a year without anything being done in the case. It was just continued over for 30 days, continued over for 60 days, continued over for 90 days, and no court action each time that the case came up. And so I brought it to the attention of the chief judge of that jurisdiction, and they had a system or have a system of commissioners that hear the cases and then do reports to the judges. And the judge just changed the system. She said, no more continuances. If lawyers want continuances, they got to ask the judges for them. And it has changed. I mean, they had like 50 cases that were had been out there continued for significant periods of time. And those continuances were cut to almost zero. Or if a case had to been continued, it was continued for a week or you know very few days. So that getting court systems and working collaboratively with court systems to look at their case management process is one very good way to help improve timelines for these kids. So for lawyers out there, for CIP directors, for child welfare folks in communities, if you don't know whether or not you have an issue about continuances, just start looking at your cases and doing some simple data collection to see whether or not it's a problem. If it is, bring it to the attention of your agency head and your chief judge and see what can be done about solving that problem. The other part of that piece is, you think you set aside a day for a trial and it's going to take 2 days. Well, creating an opportunity to pre-try these cases so that you can introduce, evidence that as part of the pre-trial conference, so you don't have to bring in extra witnesses or prolong the hearing, is another way to shorten these cases so that you don't get hung up on trial tactics as opposed to getting the evidence in that's going to get in and should get in. The other part of it is that when you get to the termination of parental rights cases, the prior court orders and the prior work of the agency needs to be well documented in the orders. The orders kind of need to be child specific and need to be filled with facts so that there's no ifs, ands, or buts about what happened before. If you have orders that aren't very clear or don't have specific facts in them that is the basis for decisions, then if you have some other judge that has to try that case because your law requires it or the other judge has recused himself or herself, then you're going to wind up with having to retry that case. And that just shouldn't happen. These cases, quite frankly, in Alexandria, we tried TPR cases in a half a day at the most, simply because our lawyers were ready. We had good orders. Our agency lawyer was putting the evidence in. through these orders and then put in evidence about what had happened since the last order was entered. And just in that regard, one of the issues that was raised in Delaware was, well, with burdens of proof, if you have a burden of proof in your abuse and neglect case of preponderance and you have a burden of proof of, in your TPR cases of clear and convincing, how can you have preponderance orders make a clear and convincing burden? And my answer is, well, if you only have one order, you may not be able to make it. You have to have other evidence. But if you have two or three or five orders where parents have not done what they're supposed to do, those five preponderance of evidence orders are going to be more than clear and convincing evidence that TPR needs to occur or that the parents haven't done what they're supposed to do. So just an example of one thing. I know I ran on. So, Bill, you have one.
Well, I wanted to follow up on what you said about continuances. I'm aware of one large court that continues 47% of all hearings in child abuse and neglect cases. That's hearings, not cases. So if you keep in mind that each case has multiple hearings, and almost half of those are continued, you can appreciate what that means to children who are waiting for permanence. It's not a pretty picture. There are, however, jurisdictions, states, and communities that have excellent continuance policies that can greatly reduce, if the court and the lawyers are committed to implementing them, can greatly reduce the number of continuances and speed the litigation process for the benefit of children. We're talking about court issues now, so if there are those of you who want to talk about agency issues, we want to give you the opportunity to do that. But there are a couple of court issues I'd like to mention. One is the notion that ideally you should have one judge hear a case from beginning to end. One judge, one family is the concept. That happens in an increasingly large number of jurisdictions, but there are still places where judges rotate and more than one or two or even three or four judges may have a piece of the action in any one case. That's not a good system for judging in child abuse and neglect cases, and at the national level, there are a number of initiatives to change that practice in those places where it still exists. By the same token, the concept of vertical representation in the way children are represented is equally critical. Sometimes children are represented, if they're represented by a law office that does exclusively child abuse and neglect litigation and represents children, they may be represented by two or three or four different lawyers during the course of that case. Ideally, they should be represented by one from the very first hearing all the way through to the end so that there's consistency in the way that child is represented and so that the advocate knows all the facts of the case, not just those that were presented to him or her before the hearing or recently in any event. Another need that courts must address is the need for adequate time to try these cases. Too many courts spend too little time on issues of too great importance to be resolved in just a matter of minutes. And that has to change and should change, and agencies should insist that courts spend more time hearing these cases.
As part of that, if I might just chime in, one of the things that I'm seeing is in some some jurisdictions are cattle call dockets.
I was just going to say that. Go ahead.
Excuse me, I'm going to take a drink of water here. And that's where, excuse me again.
That's where everybody comes in the morning or in the afternoon, or in some places even everybody comes in the morning and waits until their case is heard. And ideally, cases should be set at specific times, or at the very least in small blocks of times where two or three or four cases can be scheduled.
Before you move on, I was just thinking one of the things that might be useful to have you address, and I know you're going to have questions from other folks, but if assuming I'm an agency person, whether it be a frontline staff or a supervisor or an agency director, and I'm having issues with my court, can you talk in some of your stories about ways that I might be able to access the court? I think one of the things that happens, and as a former attorney myself, that you know, we see the guy in the robe or the woman in the robe, and we get intimidated by the whole courtroom atmosphere. And I think it would be really useful for the two of you to talk from your perspective about, you know, how do we engage the court and you know, sort of make sure that we're sitting at the table in a meaningful way or invite the judges to sit at our table in a meaningful way. And if you could talk about some of your experiences in that regard and how those things have gone, I think that would be really useful.
I think at the outset, Anita, it's like engaging anyone else. You establish a relationship with that person. You communicate in ways that build the relationship. You establish your credibility by the work you do. You do what you can to build trust and to otherwise comport with the expectations of the court for timeliness and of documentation, for punctuality. You learn what the court expects and how they want it, and you try to accommodate that. At the same time, you need to convey, in order for it to be mutually beneficial, you need to convey to the court what your needs are and how their acts or failures to act or the timeliness of their actions impede your ability to do the work that you're expected to do. And that's, I think what you're talking about gets at the issue that we're trying to promote with courts and agencies across the country, is the need to meet together and to plan together how they can improve their common objective of meeting the needs of the children and families that they have in common and that they both are responsible for serving. So ways in which that can be done are to have regular meetings either between the leadership of both institutions or among the agency head and the key leadership in that office and all the judges who hear these cases. Obviously, it depends to some extent on the size of the jurisdiction and the number of judges and the size of the agency. But one of the things that we have promoted with not all that much success is the use of memoranda of understanding to identify particular issues that the agency and the court might reach agreement on in terms of how they were going to address that issue. My experience in using MOUs in the court where I work was very successful, and other jurisdictions I know have used them with some success as well. But whatever you call it, there needs to be regular communication and contact between the leadership of the court and the child welfare agency, and they need to be engaged, actively engaged in a process of gathering data, for example, about the work that they each do, of developing goals and objectives moving forward, of maybe even going as far as a mission statement, identifying outcomes that they each want to achieve for the kids and families in their jurisdiction, development of strategic plans, action plans that address specific problems or issues. And the more of those kinds of things you do, the more you build trust and develop that relationship, and the more cooperation there is between the leadership and between the people on the front line, because they get the message that this is what leaders want and what the leaders expect of them. So those are my thoughts about how to improve the relationship and how to maximize its potential. It's all about engaging each other constructively.
If I might pick up on that, I think a couple of things. It depends on who the person is in the agency. I mean, if it's a line worker, I don't know that I would recommend to the line worker to approach the judge, but I would say, and that it really depends upon the circumstances and how well they know one another. You know, if they've known each other for 20 years and they go to church together, then that's one thing. But if there's not that kind of sort of relationship outside of a court setting, I don't know that. And you had a judge who was standoffish or not welcoming for those kinds of contact. I don't know that I would recommend that. But I would say certainly if you have a lawyer for the agency that is supportive of what you're trying to do in terms of shortening time frames and not continuing cases and making sure that you have good orders, that it would, all of which the court needs at one point or the other, then I'd say go to the lawyer and get the lawyer to reach out to the judge. Or I would go to the head of my department and say, can you ask the judge to have a meeting to talk about systems issues, to say, hey, Judge, how can we, improve what we're doing? And maybe as part of that, we can get some dialogue about something else. An example of that is when we first started Model Court, my agency wasn't filing its foster care review and petitions for review and permanency plans on time. And the tradition was to issue show causes against them. Well, it got to a point where I was worn out issuing show causes. And so I just said, we got to do something else. And so invited the chief of services in to talk about how we set up a system that will get these petitions filed on time so that they're not out of compliance. And so we can have hearings that we've already scheduled, but are waiting for the plan to be filed. And we wound up with a system that worked very well. It reduced the number of late filings. What we did was at first we put the filing date for the plans on our master calendar so that it popped up each day for me and I'd be able to see whether or not a plan was overdue. And if it was, I'd email the chief of services and say, your plan's overdue. And then I'd get a call saying, well, I'll have it to you this afternoon. Well, we still had some problems with that, and so what I had my clerk do was to the month before the plans were due, she pulled a list of all the cases that the plans were due in the following month, and we sent a memo over to the agency as a reminder, and it was more work for us to do that memo, but in the final analysis, it was less work for us because we were not getting these plans filed at the last minute and the clerk having to turn the cases around in 5 minutes instead of having 2 days to do it. So it made the clerk's office run more smoothly. It got us the filings on time, and that helped us to have the hearings on time so we didn't have to continue cases because the plan wasn't in there and ready to be heard. So it's looking at these cases systematically. I've worked with a community where the judge just said, things work well for me for the last 30 years. Why should I make any changes? And you're going to run into those kind of jurisdictions and those kind of judges, and I don't know that there's an answer for that other than you really need to have your lawyer be the advocate in court on the things that they can legitimately advocate about. No continuances. We want enough time to hear these cases and hear them timely. We need more time in court because our docket is growing and We need 2 days instead of 1 day. We don't want these motions heard in between your civil motions and criminal motions, where you only give us 5 minutes for these hearings, so that your lawyer can advocate on a legal basis, as it were, for getting some of the case management changes that will really improve the process. I'm a big believer that first things that have to happen is the court's got to get its case management process in order. And when that's done, in some cases at no additional cost or expense, but simply changing around how the cases are heard, you'll see just huge improvement in quality of representation, quality of reporting, qualities of hearings. And that makes the quality of the decision that the judge makes better.
One thing that is being done to address the situation Steve described of a judge who's been doing the same thing for 30 years and likes it just fine and doesn't see any need to change, the ABA has undertaken a project which is called the Judicial Excellence Project, and it's an attempt to establish standards for judicial performance in child abuse and neglect cases. It addresses the need for training. It addresses the administration organization of the court. It addresses the selection process for judges, retention of judges. It will discourage frequent rotation of judges. It will address issues of assignment and the length of assignment. It will address how judges are recruited, what the qualities are that judges should have who hear this kind of work. And the hope is that it will, over time, transform the quality of the bench in child abuse and neglect litigation. As many of you, I'm sure, are aware, many courts across the country rotate judges through a variety of courtrooms that hear a variety of different matters, and child abuse and neglect litigation or juvenile litigation generally is just one of the rotations. In some places, the rotation is frequent, as frequently as a week, for example, or a month. In some places, it's longer, for a year or two, but you can't do this work well if those are the lengths of time you spend in the court. It's a disservice to the public and to the agency that is working outside the court to try to resolve the problems that these children and families are experiencing.
Well, I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm through.
Another mechanism certainly would be if there are judges, if they're going to listen to somebody, it may well be another judge. So judges from other communities, judges from neighboring communities, other judges on the bench who believe in this work and believe in how it can help improve the lives of children, getting them to be the allies for whatever change you want to make. You have also the challenges here of new judges coming on the bench who haven't heard this kind of case before. The learning curve is steep. I mean, it's not just about the law and how you hear and decide these cases, but it's about child development and visitation and substance abuse and cycles of violence and all sorts of different things that impact these cases that these judges need to know more about, just as the agency lawyers and the agency representatives and the nonprofits, the CASA volunteers, need to know about the court system, so that a terrific way to build those better relationships is to do cross training. And even where you have a judge who may not be as open as you would like to being engaged in the process, get the judge to come and make a presentation or to introduce a speaker or to participate in the program. We started doing trainings every 6 months. Other communities do brown bag lunches where they bring in somebody from an agency or a mental health provider or substance abuse provider to talk about different issues that will help inform everybody about how to make the system work better. And in those kinds of informal meetings, learning happens. And you may well, as part of that process, start to engage the courts in making changes. Another thing I wanted to talk about that we're seeing out of the CFSR this time around is the use of APLA. It's not an estate that's been reviewed so far, but it's a state that I'm working in, and what we did was had the agency through the its computer system pull out for our community the number of APLA kits, and it was higher than the state average, significantly higher.
And I'm assuming everybody knows what that means, but if you might, just in case somebody doesn't.
Okay. APLA is one of the permitted goals. It's another planned permanent living arrangement. And where many states use it is for teens in care who are in independent living programs or in a residential facility or group home or something like that. What the community I'm working with decided to do was to take those children in that particular category and go back and look at them with a different point of view to see whether or not that's really the right goal. Because if you move to an APLA goal, other planned permanent living arrangement, then the likelihood that you'll ever move out of that goal is slim and none. And just taking a step back and saying, are we sure? Some of them get into the APLA goal because they're teenagers, and the perception is that they either don't want to be adopted or they can't be adopted. And as part of our process in the particular county where I was working, we got into a discussion about how children are asked about and talked to about adoption. And it was interesting that in some circumstances they're almost dissuaded from being invited to consider adoption as a possibility. And I'll give you a quick story. I did a training down for Virginia judges and sat in on one of the breakout sessions, and a lawyer, guardian ad litem, told us that she used the Adoption Saturday program to bring her older kid clients to that program, because when she was talking with them about adoption, one of the kids said, "I don't want to be adopted." And she said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Because I know so-and-so, and he's a jerk. And so all kids who are adopted are jerks." Well, when young people make decisions on that kind of information, it is clearly the wrong information, but they do. And so what she did was to bring these kids to an Adoption Saturday where they could meet the kids who were being adopted and who were clearly excited about the fact that they had found a family. And it helped turn the children's, her clients' ideas around about the topic. So if you have an Adoption Saturday program in your community and you have children who either don't understand adoption or are fearful of it or whatever, take them to an Adoption Saturday event and let them see what it's all about. and talk with them in a differently about adoption and what it can be for young people.
Can we stop and see if there are any questions?
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Mike Robin. Sir, your line is open.
This is Robin Mike, and I work in Michigan. I noticed that a lot of the continuances in the neglect abuse cases are because of pending criminal hearings. Do you find that that's common in a lot of states?
It's not uncommon. I can't speak to how frequently that occurs, but it depends to a large extent on the attitude of the judge and whether or not the judge believes that the defendant in the criminal case should have that case concluded before the child abuse and neglect case can go forward. I think that's an unfortunate position, and I don't think there's any legal requirement that be done.
And the other way that may happen is if you it all depends on who the lawyers are for the state. I mean, is there a district attorney who is doing the criminal case as well as the civil case, the abuse and neglect case, and does he or she say, oh, I'm going to take care of the criminal case first, and then we'll do the other. If that's the situation, that person needs education about the damage that is being done to the child because the case is hanging out there for however long. One of the possible solutions to that kind of a challenge would be to bring that to the attention of the court and say, look, okay, if that's what you're going to do, if you're going to insist that the criminal case be tried first, then fast-track these cases. Give them the priority on the court's docket so that we can get that criminal trial over in 60 days or 90 days or whatever it is instead of 9 months, so that you don't wind up with the child welfare case, the dependency case, the abuse and neglect case hanging out there forever.
You have
Thank
Michigan's
you
one of the states with a really good continuance policy, is it not? I guess she's gone.
Our next question comes from Elizabeth Bent. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thank you. My question is regarding an access order. I had a increased access order by a judge from 1 2-hour visit to 2 2-hour visits. And at the time that order was given, the judge said that if this had been the continuing custody order, the continuing custody would have been a certainty because of the parent's drug use. So sometimes I'm confused at how we can continue to expose the kids to drug-using parents on access when actually if we had the time for a trial, the child would have been a permanent ward. Can you help me understand how I can terminate access in situations like that while I'm waiting for a trial?
So an access order is just an order that allows the child to have visitation with the parent?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I guess there are a couple issues there for me. it's in my view, it's the right of the parent to have access to the child, and it's the right of the child to have access to the parent. And cutting off cutting off the innocent's right to visit with a parent, even if they're a substance abuser, to me is not appropriate. Now, it is appropriate if mom shows up at the visitation drunk, but it's not appropriate to use the visitation or the access of a parent to the child or vice versa as punishment for the parent for not complying with court orders. And to me, what you do is you offer the services, you note the failure of the parent to engage in the services. Excuse me, I'm going to cough again. Excuse me, and then you document your case and move on to the next step. But even where, I mean, and as part of the first round of the Child and Family Service Reviews, I think that one of the clear findings that they were able to make out of those particular CFSR round was that children, whether they were returned home or not, who had good visitation with their parents during the process of trying to get them reunited, did better, even where the parents' rights were ultimately terminated. So I'm not in favor of denying access there simply because a parent is a drug user. I don't know. I may have misunderstood the question, but that's sort of an answer I'm giving on it.
I think part of your question had to do with the expansion of the length of time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's that was without regard to anything that the parents had or hadn't done?
The parent is using drugs and not allowing the child to be staying on his regular routine during the visits. And this child was removed at birth, basically, and now the child's 1.5. I have no trial date yet for the continuing custody order.
Continuing custody order would be the hearing on the merits of the underlying petition or the termination of parental rights?
Termination of parental rights.
So have you filed a lawyer?
I filed the continuing custody order September 2006. I have no trial date.
Yeah. Who is the lawyer in the case for you, for your client?
We have a direct. Oh, the client? The client, the father?
For the agency, I mean.
Oh, yeah. We have Dennis Boone.
So can that lawyer not persuade the judge to go ahead and try the continuing custody order so that the issue of whether the child's going to be with the parents or not can be resolved?
The father's lawyer was able to take us off the trial of size because he wasn't prepared, and the father's lawyer is saying that it's better for the parent if they delay the trial, but I'm finding that it's not good for the child.
Yeah.
I do a parent or a lawyer training about these cases, and my belief is that time is the enemy of everybody. It's the enemy of the agency. It's the enemy of the parent. It's the enemy of the child. And trying to and maybe part of, and it won't necessarily help you in this case, but what it sounds like one of the things that you all need in your community is some training for the lawyers to help them better understand how these cases need to be processed and how they need to be advocates in a different way than not completely different, but in different ways than they traditionally have been as a litigator in a criminal case, hoping that, you know, the longer you continue the case, the less likely it is that somebody's going to wind up convicted. So lawyer training would be a key, not for this case, but for other cases in your community.
Thank you. That helps.
A common problem with lawyers for agencies is the question of who's calling the shots. Is it the lawyer, or is it the agency, or is it the social worker who is assigned to that case? And in some cases, it's in some jurisdictions, it's real clear who's calling the shots. In others, it's very fuzzy, and that can produce results that are unsatisfactory from the perspective of the agency, to the extent that the lawyer takes over and makes the decisions about when the case is to be tried and other aspects of the litigation. I don't know whether that's your situation or not, but it sounds like your lawyer could be more aggressive than he or she is.
Our next question comes from Joanne Gibbons. Ma'am, your line is open.
Oh, yes, yeah, thank you. And this is from Alaska, and I will tell you that Alaska can be beautiful in January.
Right.
So we look forward to your visit.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned earlier that there are kind of a list of discussion items that you like to come to the States with, and one of the things you mentioned was looking at collaborative efforts and systems that have been put in place to help with transitions. Are there any other things that you could share with us in terms of things that you would look at and be interested in discussing with folks when you do come to the States for your visits?
Have your list at hand, Steve?
I have my list here, and I'll just run down them quickly. What collaborative efforts are occurring between the Child Welfare Agency and the court system? What, number two, what approaches, if any, have the Chief Justice, Head of Child Welfare, and the Chief Judge in the largest jurisdiction taking concerning court agency cooperation on child welfare cases? What areas have been identified as needing agency and legal court system change based on current agency policies, data, reports, your concept of best practices, what are the agency goals for improvement of child abuse and neglect cases require ongoing court agency collaboration based on existing judicial data, reports, et cetera. What court improvement goals require ongoing court agency collaboration? As the court and the agency cooperate during this process, how do you perceive that this will help achieve court and agency goals to improve the handling of child dependency cases? In other words, how do you see what you're doing now, how is it going to impact? In the process of this collaboration and cooperation, what strategies have you put in place? Or do you plan to put in place to ensure the collaboration is effective and long-term? What written action plans would clarify and reinforce the collaboration? How might the court and the agency work together to prepare for and collaborate on the statewide assessment portion of the CFSR? What's the status of specific activities that are planned in that regard? Have you thought about some helpful legal court system activities in preparation for the CFSR, such as judges participating in the on-site review process, the logistics of how, you know, who's coming where and how you're going to get people to appear for interviews and that sort of thing? What kind of preparation are you providing? For instance, for judges who are being interviewed, one of the things that I heard about from the last round of the CFSRs, for instance, was that a judge was interviewed in a state. He had not talked to anybody else or any other judges about any of his issues, and so he answered the questions on behalf of the state, but reflecting what was a challenge in his community. And suddenly that became an issue for the whole state to have to solve when it wasn't a problem in the rest of the state. So making sure that if a judge is going to be interviewed, that he or she has had the chance to talk with other judges and make sure that the answer is couched in terminology that will reflect how limited the understanding is or how broad it is, depending upon what kind of conversations they've had. We're interested in whether the Chief Justice will lead the CFSR effort on behalf of the court system or refer it to another justice or someone else in the administrative office. Let's see, next steps to be taken, when and by whom regarding organizing the collaboration between the agency and the court system. From the point of view of the CIP director and the CFSR director for the agency, really looking at what are you all doing hands-on and to address these issues, plus whatever else may be facing you all, like continuances or APLA or TPRs or whatever you all have already identified in your community or in your state as being a problem. And I apologize. I know Alaska is beautiful in the winter. I was just thinking about the snow and the
I know.
Get in and out, you know.
Thank you very much.
Anita, do these folks have access to our email addresses so that we can send them?
We can do that. I also was going to talk at the end about the fact that your services are available through the ABA Center, in terms of if people want to request technical assistance, they can do that. So we'll talk about that at the very end.
Okay. Any other questions?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. If you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound. I'm showing no questions at this time.
I'd be interested in if you could talk about some specific work that you all have done, some of your focused work in one or two states, just to share with folks some of the possibilities that they could use your technical assistance or the TA from the resource centers.
Sure. Let me start. Some of the kinds of things that I've been doing here recently, I do a presentation on judicial ethics for judges. That talks about how they can get off the bench and do off the bench kind of work and not run into ethical problems. And I've done a presentation in Idaho, did one here recently in Colorado, and I'm going out to Washington in September to do one. Sometimes judges are saying, "Oh, well, I can't do that because it would be an ethical conflict," and what I really have found in my research is that, in some respects, judges really need to get off the bench and become engaged in collaborative work in order to make the systems work better, which I think is part of what they are called ethically to do. I'm doing hands-on work in Tennessee and in Virginia. Virginia has the Best Practice Courts Initiative. That I'm helping out with, working with a city and a county to help them develop improved process a variety of things. I'm doing help them develop a drug court, family treatment drug court. I look at whatever the particular challenges are for a community, try to help them identify them, help them to figure out what they want to tackle first, and then go after it. What I try to do is to encourage with any kind of systems change, you gotta start small and get some easy wins under your belt. If you talk about we're going to change this whole system over here to get better substance abuse treatment, you'll never get there simply because you'll be exhausted by the time you try and people will give up. But if you want to, for instance, one of the things we had a problem with was getting early evaluations for mental health and substance abuse. And so what I did was I went and talked to our mental health substance abuse provider and said, how can we get these people to you sooner than 2 or 3 months? And he said, you can't. And I said, well, maybe we can. How can we? You can't. And after a month or so of talking, we finally came to one of those memorandums of understanding that Bill was talking about, and we wound up with a process where every Friday I had two slots at 10 o'clock. And if I didn't use either one of them 2 weeks before that particular date, then I lost it. So that the substance abuse provider or mental health provider could put missed appointments or emergencies in to that time slot. But otherwise, I got them, and so I wound up getting families to being evaluated within a couple weeks rather than a couple months. So we all, we both won in that circumstance. Just trying to, you know, one of the things that we do is help communities build the collaborative group. The Permanency Barriers Project for the ABA does that on an ongoing basis and is, really does have good success. It's bringing to the table agency lawyers, judges, you know, your CASA volunteers, your service providers. One of the situations we had was we'd get people ready to have their children come back home, and housing was a problem, and so you know, and so you couldn't reunite the family, and so we brought our housing authority in to help respond to that issue by using what are called family unification vouchers that HUD has that will promote reunification, because when mom loses that the kids and she's in a two or three bedroom Section 8 housing, then she loses the two or three bedroom and may get a one bedroom or may not get anything at all. And then when you go to try to reunite, she doesn't have the housing. So we use these family unification vouchers for that. And they're available through any housing authority around the country.
Also a priority in public housing for victims of domestic violence with children.
Yeah.
Which I think there's a local option with respect to all those priorities, but where it exists, it can be very useful.
Well, and that's where you wind up with your memorandum of understanding. We do it with children 0 to 3. If you have an early Head Start program in your community, go meet with them, get the court to the table so that those children can move to the top of the list or into an open slot because they're entitled to that under the law.
There are a number of things, I think, in addition to what Steve spoke of, that we can do or that we can services that we can connect you with that other people can, who may have more expertise than we do, can assist in. The things that come to mind immediately, we already talked about agency attorneys, and there are lots of issues regarding how agencies are represented that are being addressed in a variety of ways in different jurisdictions across the country. And if that's an issue, there are resources for addressing that issue. Visitation, we talked some about that earlier, but visitation is a huge issue. When, where, how often, who supervises, what about domestic violence? There's a whole new initiative to promote visitation coaching, particularly in New York and the city with ACS. The issue of continuances we've talked about and others of the issues that we've discussed regarding how courts could function better, like the one judge, one family thing, the rolling trials, as Judge Grace in Massachusetts calls these PPRs that Steve was referring to. They're continued from time to time to time, but don't have to be. A couple of the other things I mentioned, like the one judge, one family vertical representation, there are models for doing all those things that would be easily transportable to other courts or to many other courts.
One of the real issues that's coming up as a result of the Federal Interstate Placement of Children Act is that foster parents, adoptive parents are entitled to notice and opportunity to be heard in court. There's a real move around the country to get to have children have be brought to court. Kentucky, as I recall, Kentucky has a law which requires the kids to go to court. There certainly are exceptions, but the presumption is that they're going to go to court. In regard to a foster parent, let me just tell you another quick story. But I was filling in for Judge Dawkins. I have a permanency plan for adoption. Social worker, guardian ad litem come in. Foster parents and the 10 or 11 year old boy come in. And it's clear just from watching them walk into the courtroom that these foster parents are connected to this boy. And social worker says, oh, our goal is adoption, and I'm waiting for her to say, and we're going to move to have the foster parents adopt, and she doesn't, and the guardian ad litem stands up and says, yes, we think adoption's the right thing, and the foster parent, he's just crawling to stand up and say something, and so I invite him to say something. Well, he was the most eloquent person, 10 or 15 minutes, talking about how much he cared about this boy, how much they wanted to have him as part of their lives, the fact that the foster father had been in foster care himself, and he didn't want to see this boy put in a similar circumstance, and it was clear, had I not had those people there, that the social worker may not have gone off to make that inquiry, because they were there, she was there, and she didn't know that he wanted to adopt. So there are all of those kinds of issues that we, if you're having them in your community, the ABA can be of assistance in terms of training and technical assistance through your state court improvement program, or locally if you go through your regional office at the Children's Bureau.
Family finding is another issue that courts need to do a better job of addressing. Locating absent members of the family, either the biological father or members of his family or other extended family who may provide permanent homes for kids, and there are increasingly sophisticated tools for doing that that are available at low cost, if any cost, one of which is the Federal Parent Locator Service, the child support system, and addressing child support in child abuse and neglect cases is also something that can and should be done, particularly if the goal is to obtain support from a non-custodial parent to be paid to the custodial parent, because it can be a resource that, a financial resource that would not otherwise be available to enable that parent to get back on his or her feet and provide more appropriate care for the child.
Great. Well, I'm going to take the last minute or so to thank Judge Rideout and Judge Jones. I thought you did a great job. I appreciate it, and I'm sure all of our participants do. And also just to tell people that there are technical assistance available to your state, as Judge Jones just mentioned, through the Court Improvement Program or through whoever in your child welfare agency is responsible for asking for technical assistance, either through our resource center, the Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, or through the ABA, through the Legal and Judicial Resource Center. I will say that you just should have received during the course of the conference call an email from Marty Snyder reminding you that there is an evaluation. We would appreciate it if you would fill it out and send it in, because we do read them and pay attention. And also that I will discuss with the presenters and send you email addresses if you have any further questions. For either of them or for me. If either of you have something else to add, I would let you do that. Otherwise, we will say goodbye.
Let me add that there are some good materials on the website about the court and agency collaboration, and I recommend them to you for review. They may well give you some other ideas of ways to help improve that process.
Yes, and the ABA has a ton of resources on their website as well.
There's also a piece about how to engage courts and judges.
Yep.
In the user manual, which was attached to the material that you provided, Anita.
Yep, those are all available on our website, and we'll be there for a while.
Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the conference, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.